relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
If you like America First, then check out our separate podcast, The Battle for 1600, with my former White House colleague, Boris Epstein. Every week, we give you the inside, in-depth analysis of what's really going on. The Battle for 1600. Subscribe today. He may have a peculiar relationship to the letter E, but he's still the galactic supermaster, Andrew Klavan. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First, and please welcome our very special guest host.
He says it so you know it's true. Andrew Klavan sitting in for the great Dr. Sebastian Gorka on American First, and we are entering the Daily Wire zone. We're entering a half hour, a pure crystal, kind of sparkling half hour of Daily Wire content because I have with me my Daily Wire compadre, Michael Knowles, who runs the Michael Knowles Show, the creatively named Michael Knowles Show on the Daily Wire, but also is the author of the so-called best-selling. Well, you know, we say it's best-selling. It's called Speechless. The book is called Speechless, Controlling Words, Controlling Minds. And yes, it has been on every bestseller list in the country at the top, but the New York Times is the gold standard, my friend. So have they yet admitted, fallen to their knees and admitted that you are, in fact, a bestseller?
I don't think they understand the irony of what they are doing, or I suppose not the irony, just how fitting it is. I think I might have to send them a muffin basket, because after they snubbed me, like the left so often does, they redefined words. They redefined the word bestseller to mean not a bestseller, right? All the books that sold fewer copies. But ever since then, the book jumped even higher up the charts. It then hit number one on Amazon among all books. For the first and probably only time in my life, I can say I beat Quentin Tarantino. He had his novel come out, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We were ahead of that at number one. And so my sincere thanks to the New York Times for getting people to read a book now that will explain why they're so completely full of it.
I love the fact that somewhere, like, the demon of the New York Times is, like, curled up in a corner just hating the fact that your book is selling. You know, they'd give themselves away. Now, I want you to know that, you know, because I'm doing Sebastian's show, I did, and he sounds just like a Bond villain. I did have this kind of urge to have you on, strapped to a table with a laser coming up to destroy you.
What, like, do you expect, like, of me, Drew? Yeah. Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. This is Sebastian Gorka. but I contain myself. I restrain myself. So this is a book about political correctness, but it's different. I mean, it is not just a hit, the usual, you know, seven reasons the left stinks. It is actually a history of how this idea came into being. Give us a quick rundown of how the idea did come into being.
Well, this began, I think, about 100 years ago. Most people trace political correctness back 20 or 30 years. I think it's further back. I think it goes back to about the 1920s. I am hesitant to mention that a lot of Marxists were involved in developing this because, you know, the right blames Marx and Marxists for everything. But the fact is, they were responsible for a lot of bad things.
They weren't the greatest people.
Yeah, right. And so you've got to call it like you see it. However, as you say, the book is a little different, I think, than most conservative polemics in the sense that I point out plenty of terrible things the left has done, and I criticize the left for it. But frankly, I reserve more of my ire for the right because I think one of the things the right has done so wrong is we've just dismissed these leftist intellectuals and leaders who have developed this extraordinarily effective strategy of manipulating language to their own ideological ends. And I think we've dismissed them and ignored them at our own peril. The fact is, the leftist intellectuals who created PC understood political correctness and, in my view, free speech and censorship much better than most people on the right do. I think they were brilliant political tacticians, and I think you're seeing that brilliance today in the way that they have so utterly upended our culture. And I think if we don't take them seriously, beginning in the 20s and going all the way up through 2020, I think we're only going to lose more ground. And frankly, there's not much more ground to lose.
Well, you know, one of the things that has really been disturbing to me in this last kind of iteration of political correctness, for a while it was kind of they shamed you. They kind of said, it's just polite. It's just being polite. And they kind of used our system of manners to shut us up, to make us feel like, oh, you have to say this word instead of that word. You have to, you know, put it that way instead of this way. And if you didn't get it right, you were racist, you were sexist, all these things. But now they've gotten bold. Now they are really ready to make you lose your job if you don't put things exactly, if you don't think the way they think. And one of the tools that they have been using is corporate media. If Amazon takes your book off its website, which sells, I think, 90% of new books in the country, you are effectively censored. If Twitter takes the president of the United States, the former president of the United States, off their website, he has lost a major platform in which to speak. Now, a lot of people on the right say, well, those are free market, independent, private institutions. They have the right to do that, and we don't want to give the government the power to force them not to do it. What do you think?
Well, it's wrong for two reasons. One, the build your own Twitter crowd forgets that we did build our own Twitter. It's called Parler. And what did they do? They kicked it out of the App Store, which effectively took it off of smartphones. And then just to give the final punch, they took it off of desktop because Amazon Web Services removed it from its servers. So what's build your own internet, build your own society. I guess that's what we're trying to do. That's the purpose of politics. But then even beyond that, Twitter and even more so Facebook and Google control the flow of information around the internet, which is the public square. So they control speech. And in a democratic republic, if you control speech, you control politics. The way we govern ourselves, at least in theory, is that we speak to one another and persuade one another and deliberate and then come to some sense of how we're all going to live together. So if my rights are being taken away by hipster Rasputin, Jack Dorsey in Silicon Valley, that doesn't make me feel any better than if they're being taken away by some bureaucrat. And to your point, Drew, on politeness, I think that's such an important one because the left is not acting very politely, but they are using our desire to be polite against us. Sometimes people will say political correctness is a speech code that tells you can't say certain things. Well, that's true, but so is chivalry, right? So is manners and politeness. But there's a difference in the way that political correctness has done it, namely, When I call an older woman of a certain age, I'm being polite. I'm not lying. I'm softening the reality. I'm not calling her an old hag, but I'm not lying. If I call a man a woman, I am lying. If I call a juvenile delinquent a justice-involved youth, that's actually the term that is used in the academy and in a lot of the legal profession. I am lying because the youth is involved in the opposite of justice. He's involved in injustice. So much of what political correctness does is not use euphemisms to soften reality, but actually to invert it. And so that's the soft censorship. And then they have the overt censorship on big tech, which in the words of Mitch McConnell, is operating like a sort of woke parallel government at this point. Yeah, and I think we have the political right to intervene.
This is one of the reasons that I just feel that people who say we shouldn't stop Amazon from censoring books are living in the past. I mean, basically, I agree with Lincoln that our Constitution doesn't mention God, but it's based on the Declaration, and the Declaration says we have God-given rights, and governments are instituted among men to preserve those rights. To me, that means that if it's Amazon taking away my rights, or whether it's Washington taking away my rights, the government is obligated to stop that from happening. That is the purpose and the reason they're there. And I understand that creates difficulties in law, but it still seems to me that if we are going to be able to speak freely, we have to be able to do that. Now, there are technical answers. I mean, Dan Bongino just started a PayPal, that shouldn't be censorable. And I know our pal Dave Rubin has got a new, his local site. Do you look forward to this? I've only got about a minute until the next segment, because I'm not letting you go until the next segment. But do you think that the answer may be more technology rather than less?
Sure, I'm all for more technology, but ultimately you are going to run into the Amazon Web Services problem. Ultimately, you're going to run into people denying that you can have a domain registration. I mean, this goes pretty high up, and it's also a little blurry, the distinction between public and private and free enterprise and government here. I think Google is pretty tight with the government, and whether that's the government of China or the government of the United States is a bigger problem. But I think, you know, the easy dichotomies of, say, the 1980s and 90s, I don't think they're quite so clear, because I think the liberal establishment have kind of fused into this blob, and we need to be creative to figure out how to push back against it.
Absolutely. Michael Knowles, the author of Speechless, Controlling Words, Controlling Minds, a bestseller absolutely everywhere except on the pages of the New York Times, where they just can't stand it. We will talk to Michael more as we come back. I have to tell you that I was walking around Washington, D.C. over the 4th of July weekend, and I saw that fence that they have built around the Capitol, and it breaks your heart. It breaks your heart. You know, I think, I was obviously not in favor of charging into the Capitol on January 6th, but they have used it like the Reichstag fire to just surround themselves, to cut themselves off even further from the people. Their responsibility to you, their respect for you, their respect for your rights, their respect especially for your right to speak is gone. It's gone. It's not fading away. It is gone. They are actually out to stop you. And if they can do it through corporations, that's what they'll do. We will be back with America First. Sebastian Gorka is not here, but Andrew Klavan is.
Relief Factor. Have you tried every other form of pain relief only to fail and not find your answer? Well, try this incredible product that is providing liberation from pain to tens of thousands of Americans across the country, including Alicia from California. I'm a grocery store worker and have been working doubles during this coronavirus shutdown. At 52 years old, my two bad knees are not getting a rest. I literally limp to and from bed. 2 days into Relief Factor and the pain has decreased substantially. So thankful for this amazing product. That could be you. It should be you. Find out today the only way you can by ordering the 3-week quick starter pack at relieffactor.com. Call them at 800-500-8384. It'll be at your door in 3 days or less. Take it morning and evening just like I do. And I promise you, by the end of those 3 weeks, you will know whether it works for you like it works for me, Alicia, and thousands of your fellow Americans. What have you got to lose except the pain? Do it today. 800-500-8384. ReliefFactor.com. ReliefFactor.com.
On the side of the U.S. Constitution, America First.
That is us. This is Andrew Klavan sitting in for Sebastian Gorka on American First. Not doing, by force of will, not doing my Sebastian Gorka imitation just so I can sound like a James Bond villain. But when it comes to villainy, we have an expert on. We have Michael Knowles from The Daily Wire, my compadre at The Daily Wire. He has written a book, Speechless, Controlling Words, Controlling Minds, which would be a bestseller everywhere if and only if the New York Times would simply break down and admit that the book is selling out like hotcakes. Knowles, so you have a quote in here that I think is I think it's at the heart of some of the stuff you're saying. And it's really different than the free speech absolutists, obviously. But it's not I think it's not quite as far as some people who would just kind of float the Vatican into Washington and drop it from a helicopter. The quote is, in a self-governing republic, speech is politics and politics is speech. As the realm of politics requires limits, so too must the realm of speech. By failing to acknowledge this practical reality, the so-called free speech purists give the game away to politically correct censors. In other words, if we don't say that something has to be censored, we're not really fighting fire with fire. Is that a fair way to put it?
Sure. And yes, I think it's fair, but I would go even further. I'm not merely giving the prescription here that we need to censor people more or something like that, or I'm not merely saying that we need to construct our own standards out of thin air, though I do think we need to embrace standards. I'm making a descriptive observation about politics that all societies will have taboos. That is inevitable. That has been true everywhere in history. It's certainly been true in America. And there have always been limits. And those limits, some have been imposed at the federal level. Many, many more have been imposed at the state level or at the local level. But that is simply going to happen. And so what we have come to view as a battle between free speech in the abstract and censorship in the abstract, I think it's really just a battle between competing sets of standards. And the problem is that the right does not want to articulate any standards. The left, whatever you want to say about them, they have a vision of what the country should be. They want to tear down Washington. They want to tear down Jefferson. They want to tear down everything. And they want to set the whole thing on fire because they believe America is a vicious, evil, racist, bigoted place. And the whole country is centered around slavery, which did not end in 1865, but it's still going on today, they will tell you, right? And so, but that's their vision. It's bonkers, but that's what they believe. What is the right offering in its place? I think we're offering a bunch of procedural arguments about academic freedom and free speech in the abstract, but I don't think we have very much to say in practice.
But it is different to propose alternative values. And to be fair to the left, they're tearing down George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, but they are building statues to George Floyd, for his amazing, amazing contributions to our culture. But it's one thing to articulate standards, but it's another thing to impose those standards and to cut off any conversation opposed to those standards. That's where I guess I always worry about this. I think it's a delicate conversation because I'm not a free speech absolutist. I would happily censor pornography if it were possible. I would happily censor, foul language in public places. So then CNN would then go off the air. But still, I think there when it comes to ideas, I do feel that conversation has to continue. We have to win in the public sphere, in public argument.
Sure. Well, I think we all should agree. At least we agree. I actually don't think a lot of the conservatives that we're talking about here would necessarily agree with this, but they should because it's so obvious. There is no First Amendment protection for threats, fraud, sedition, obscenity, right? They're fighting words. There are many exceptions to First Amendment protections for free speech. But you say, what about the realm of ideas? Well, surely you would agree we should not tolerate critical race theory or radical transgender theory in the classroom. Right?
The classroom is a really interesting place because it obviously is if you have public schools, you have to send your kids there. You can't always afford to send your kids to private schools. So yes, the state should be able to control what is taught there. When people say, there was an op-ed in the New York Times today saying, no, it's a terrible, terrible thing to stop free speech in the classroom. Well, I don't think a kindergartner needs to go in and hear that his whiteness is a bad thing any more than I would tolerate for 3 seconds his going in and hearing that blackness was a bad thing. I don't understand why. Nobody would complain if you censored white supremacy in the public schools. So why would you complain if you censor anti-white bigotry? But schools are a particular place. They are not television. They're not the places where people argue. They're not the debating hall. That's where I worry. Like, who am I going to give that power to censor a debate?
I think that, yes, this is a very good point. And obviously the classrooms, they're government institutions when we're talking about public schools. And parents have the right that they're now asserting at these school board meetings to go in and say, get this nonsense out of my kids' classrooms. What about in the public square? There have been so many fights over the years, and I chronicle some of them in Speechless, over, say, the Ten Commandments outside of a courthouse or in a public square. Is that permissible? And the court has ruled that it is permissible, but not for the reason that I think the Founding Fathers would have believed or the colonists before the Founding Fathers. The courts ruled in the 20th century that you can have some kind of a Christmas display, for instance, a nativity display, because it has a secular aspect to it. So not because the baby Jesus is obviously religious, but because it has a secular component to it as well. Okay, fine. Should we be forced to permit a statue of Baphomet in the public square, some kind of satanic symbol? You see, radical atheists and radical Satanists have always tried to, I suppose that's a redundant statement, but they have often tried to say, well, if you're going to permit public displays that have anything to do with Christianity, you need to permit a statue of Satan in the public square. I think what a lot of those debates come down to is this question of, is secular liberalism a neutral playing ground where we can debate ideas, or do we have to privilege certain ideas? You know, John Locke, father of liberalism, in his letter concerning toleration, he says, you can't really tolerate atheism, at least not very much, because then you'll undermine your free speech regime. John Milton says, you can't really tolerate Catholics, and I see why. You know, I know so many Catholics, and they really, you know,
they're
horrible
folks.
Horrible people, you know. But I do see why. He was speaking in a very particular political context in England with these religious wars, that there has to be at a basic level something that we are asserting. And we just celebrated the 4th of July. In America, we assert that our Creator endows us with certain unalienable rights. It is a specifically Christian view that we are asserting. The country is not a secular neutral playing ground. We are saying we believe that. And for the past 50 or 60 years, the left has tried to deny that sort of thing. But I think it is dishonest to pretend that we don't really have those.
Yeah, I mean, Antonin Scalia used to say that the government is not allowed to elevate one religion, but it is allowed to elevate religion over atheism. I would go even further than that. I would say, because of that quote you just mentioned, we know it's not necessarily Christian, but we know our God has a nature. We know the God that is the axiomatic God of America has endowed us with certain rights. He is the sort of God who endows his creatures with rights and with freedoms, and not the sort of God who is irresponsible to logic or people or individuals' rights. Michael Knowles, the author of Speechless, Controlling Words, Controlling Minds. Get it before the New York Times just absolutely explodes with envy over its bestsellerdom. It's always good to see you, Knowles, and I will see you in a couple days in Nashville at the Daily Wire.
America First. Magnificent.
Andrew Klavan sitting in for Sebastian Gorka on America First. Give me a call if you've got questions or if there's something you want to talk about at 833-33-GORKA, 833-334-6752. I love talking to you. You may have to wait a little while, but hopefully we will get to you as quickly as we can. I love talking to people because I already know what I think. You know, I actually want to hear more about what other people think or what's on their minds and what they'd like to ask about. You know, I talked about that poll earlier that says that most people are really proud to be Americans. And this is one of the interesting things. The Democrats, or at least the left-wing Democrats, the people that are now in charge, because nobody thinks that Joe Biden is in charge. I mean, really, nobody thinks. They ask him what flavor ice cream he's eating because they think he might be able to answer that question. They're not asking him the complicated questions because nobody thinks he's running the country. I mean, look at the guy. He doesn't even walk like he's in his own body. He walks as if he's somebody's pulling the strings. So the thing about these guys who are running the country is Biden was put in office because they didn't want the radicals. They wouldn't vote for the radicals, and they knew it. The Democratic Party knew it. And so they put Biden in as this kind of mannequin, this sort of ventriloquist dummy through whom the radicals could speak, because he's too far gone really to stop them and really to say to them, you know, this is not what America wants. But America doesn't want it. 86% of adults over the age of 65, basically over 80% of adults say they are proud to be Americans. And the only people who don't show up for that are the kids, young adults. In the, what was it, the 18 to 24, something like that range, who say they're not proud. Well, why is that? Why aren't we countering that? First of all, of course, it's because of the long march through our institutions. It's because they own the academies. They own the schools. They own Hollywood. everything these kids see tells them that there is a better way. And they have come up with this really clever thing, which they call critical theory. We know about critical race theory, but critical race theory is only one kind of critical theory. And what critical theory is just that. It's criticizing things. It's criticizing things without saying, answering the question that every leftist should be asked. If we had an honest press, every leftist would be asked the following question, as opposed to what? America is a racist country, as opposed to what? America is not a free country, as opposed to what? They never ask those questions because all they do is criticize, and anything, of course, can be criticized. But the underlying, unspoken assumption is that they have something better, and that something better is socialism. And kids love socialism. Why? Because it just sounds nice. It sounds nice. This is the thing about capitalism. It doesn't sound nice. We compete. We're fighting. We're arguing. You know, you have to come. If you don't do the right thing, you go out of business and then you have no money and then, you know, have to go to work, you know, flipping burgers and, oh, how terrible. It's like there are no participation trophies. You know, it's just win or lose. It sounds really cruel. And then you say, well, everybody should have money. Everybody should have health care. Everybody should have this and that. And that just sounds good if you're a young person. And frankly, youth and ignorance are synonyms. It's the same thing. You simply don't have time to learn what you have to learn until you get a little bit older. But the thing is, conservatives fight this with a stupid argument. What they say is, conservatives say, well, socialism doesn't work. And that's more or less true, but it works well enough. I mean, you can have a lot of socialism before it stops working. The thing about socialism that we never say is it's inherently immoral. And those are the arguments that win. The arguments that win are moral arguments. That's why the left is so powerful, even though look at their cities. Look at San Francisco. 40% of people want to leave San Francisco because it has fallen into disarray. It has fallen into chaos because of leftist governance. And yet they still are out there pushing the leftism because they do it in a moral way. Oh, look at the poor so-and-so. Aren't you going to help him? But socialism is inherently immoral because it lives in a lie. And the lie is that there is such a thing called the state that will act benevolently. The state is powerful people. And as Lord Acton told us, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. So what happens is if you have a form of government like our republic where power and power centers are limited and the power, no one body has all the power. The Supreme Court doesn't have it all. The president doesn't have it all. Congress doesn't have it all. The Senate doesn't have it all. It's all distributed and they're all fighting each other to keep them within bounds. And the Constitution keeps them within bounds. It creates a fairly decent governing class. Until about, I don't know, I would say 50 years ago, we had a fairly decent governing class because of the rules of the road that the Constitution imposed. That created the illusion. That creates the illusion that the socialists now live in, that the state is basically benevolent. It's only there to help. Remember Reagan's famous, most frightening words, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." And the reason is that is an illusion. Once you start giving the government more and more and more power, they will become more and more and more corrupt and more and more and more abusive. And we saw this during the lockdown. We saw it with the antipathy toward religion because that's an opposing value system, an opposing spiritual power that they don't like. So they suddenly said, yeah, Walmarts can stay open, but you can't go to church. You go to church, you can't sing. You can't pray. Don't look up because you might be communicating with God. That'll get you the flu. You'll get the flu and die. You know, that's the illusion. It's inherently immoral. It is inherently oppressive. And that's what we have to teach the youth.
Never losing sight of the fact that our American journey is one we must walk together with respect and inclusivity, always striving to find the good in each other, and to remember that to truly love our country, we need to love one another.
That was Vanessa Williams, the former Miss America, for about 10 seconds during the Reagan administration until they uncovered nude pictures of her doing an SM shoot, as I recall, and she was thrown out of being Miss America. But a talented singer and a talented actress, and she was singing Lift Every Voice and Sing, which has come to be known, as unfortunately, as the Black National Anthem. It was a poem written in 1900 to celebrate Lincoln's birthday, a poem written by a black poet, and it has become known as the Black National Anthem. And, you know, this is the year that, as Donald Trump once wanted, but then, of course, it was evil, but now it's okay, that Juneteenth became a holiday. And a lot of right-wingers reacted to that, saying Juneteenth shouldn't be a holiday. But, of course, you know, that's the end, celebrates the end of slavery, and that is a major, major moment in our history, and I have no problem with it being a holiday. What galled me about it was, first of all, a couple of things galled me about it. One of the things that galled me about it was that the Democrat Party has been the worst thing that ever happened to black people on this planet. I mean, they were the slaveholders. They were against the first Republican, Abraham Lincoln, when they lost the war and didn't want to give up their slaves. They invented Jim Crow. They invented the Ku Klux Klan. They are the ones who did all of that. And their narrative is then everything changed when Richard Nixon came in. And he had the Southern Strategy, and that expelled all the Dixiecrats, that attracted all the Dixiecrats so that they were taken out of the Democrat Party. It's a totally untrue philosophy. The Republican Party has always been the party of no racism, not anti-racism, which is just racism by another name, but has been the party of no racism. So that galled me a little bit. But the other thing that galls me is it is part of this full court press to deny that the founding was a founding on the idea of liberty and equality of treatment. And in fact, to say that our real founding was somehow mixed up with, was embedded with slavery, which is just untrue. I mean, it's untrue. You know, the idea that we have racism in our DNA, that the country has racism in our DNA, is provably untrue, because DNA makes you more of what you are, right? If you're an oak tree and you have oak tree DNA, you become more of an oak tree as the years go by. And America has clearly become less and less and less racist. And now I would say there are no racist institutions. There's no institutional racism. There's no systemic racism. What there is, however, there is a reason why Democrats have a tremendous, tremendous investment in keeping the idea of racism alive, and that is the Great Society. The Great Society has poured money into the coffers of Democrats, and it has used taxpayer dollars to give Democrats a way of buying votes from the black community, saying, look what we are giving you. But in fact, the spiral downward of those black communities that are dysfunctional began after the Great Society came in. So they were not the result of slavery. They were not the result of Jim Crow. They were the result of a welfare system that paid women to have children out of wedlock and therefore destroyed many families, including black families. At the time, originally, blacks had a out-of-wedlock birth rate of about 25%. Now it's 75%, which is worse than when the Democrats were actually selling them down the river to break up families on purpose. They found a way to just pay them to break up families, and it has been an absolute, absolute disaster. And one of the things that was happening under Donald Trump is that through his actions, Donald Trump was turning the narrative around. He created an economy where more black people were working than ever before, where the black unemployment rate was lower than ever before. And suddenly, people were finding out the great truth that working for a living gives you dignity. Working for a living gives you meaning. Putting your hands, no matter what you do, if it's an honest job, I have had so many jobs. I've been a warehouseman, a driver. I've done all kinds of things in my life. I'm a writer. I had to do all kinds of things before I made my way. And I used to say to myself, even as a kid, anything I put my hands on, I am going to do to the best of my ability and with all the dignity I have. That's where the panic came from. That is where the panic came from. When George Floyd died, that did not look like a good piece of policing to me. It didn't look like murder to me either, but it didn't look like a good piece of policing to me. Police killing innocent black suspects is statistically almost a non-existent event. When you remember that this is a country of 350 million people, when you remember that there are at least 700,000 law enforcement officers in this country, that is the number of times that it happens that where it's even a suspicious death, like that death where you thought, like, well, that could have been handled a lot better. That didn't have to go that way. Maybe he did die of fentanyl, but still, you should have taken your knee off his back. Whatever you think about that, that's never happens. It doesn't happen. Now, look, we can understand that black crime is high. You know, 7% of the country, black males commit 50% of the murders, just about. I mean, that's really the rate. So you can understand that a cop sees a black face and he gets suspicious. You can understand if you're one of the majority of black people who are innocent, just going about your business, that doesn't feel so good. That feels pretty bad. I mean, the cop isn't being racist. He's just being a cop. He's saying, how can I keep people safe? The people he's trying to keep safe have the same color as the bad guy. He's just trying to keep people safe. But if you're an innocent person and you're being rousted by the police because he gets suspicious of you because you have a black face, you can understand that's going to cause hostility. We understand that there's a problem there. We understand that there's a problem. But it really does go back to the Great Society, and that is what nobody wants to talk about. They keep saying, oh, we're having a racial reckoning. We're having a racial reckoning. We are not. We are having a moment when blacks were willing to say, you know what, we're going to assimilate now. You saw it. You saw it in plays like Hamilton, where black people were playing the founding fathers. That's a way of saying, yes, this is my country. This is my history, too. That when the Democrats saw that, it just sent a fire up them. When they realized that blacks were becoming just another assimilating group in America, which is as it should be. Each group has to assimilate. Each group has its problems. Blacks have double problems because the offenses that were done against them were happened here, where most of us are coming from countries where they happen. So they need a little extra grace. We all understand that. We all have sympathy for that. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the fact that Democrats will not take their clutches off them. They will not let them out of their clutches. They've got them. They've got them dependent on their systems. They've got them dependent on their ideas, and they will not let them go. As black people, more and more black people make it into society. You know, a lot of people say that they're trying to replace white people by opening the borders. I don't think so. I think they're trying to replace black voters who are going to get wise to the fact that they are not getting anything from the Democrat Party and never have. All right, Andrew Klavan here for Sebastian Gorka on America First. You know, it's become such a cliche to attack the press, to attack the media, that I don't think we understand just what a disaster the media has wrought on this country. I sometimes watch people. Molly Hemingway. I love Molly Hemingway. I'm sure most of you have seen Molly on Fox or somewhere. She's a terrific commentator and just a really, really bright woman and articulate woman. But I watched her because she went through certain stages that I went through. I lived out of the country for 7 years in the 90s. And when I came back, I was absolutely shocked at what had happened to the country. I was shocked after 9/11, which happened right after I got back from 7 years in England. I was shocked to hear like comedians like David Letterman saying, why do they hate us? And I thought, who cares why they hate us? They're fascists. They're Nazis. They're supposed to hate us. They're supposed, you know, those are the guys you want to have hating you. I was shocked to see what had happened. And I watched Molly kind of that developing idea where first you think, wow, the media is really biased. And then you think, they're not biased. They're like all on one side. And then suddenly you go like, oh, my Lord, they are utterly, utterly corrupt. And the effect of that, and it's true not just of the news media, but also of the entertainment media, is incredibly divisive. All during, I mean, it's still true today, but it was just kind of obvious during the Trump administration. Every single comedian on TV was anti-Trump. And the one time Jimmy Fallon made a mildly nice remark where he had Trump on and kind of rustled his hair, they browbeat him until he went over and became anti-Trump. Now, what's the effect of that? You know, you go back into the old days where you had, even before Jay Leno, you had Johnny Carson. And Johnny Carson was a lifelong Democrat, but Johnny Carson would always make jokes about both sides. So what happens when you make jokes about both sides? You laugh. You laugh at both sides. You know, if a guy makes a joke about a Democrat, you laugh because you're a Republican. And then he makes a joke about a Republican. You say, OK, fair. You know, we both have our foibles. We both are kind of funny. And you laugh. But if every single day Stephen Colbert comes on and says, Trump, 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 evil, 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 those stupid Trump voters, those stupid Trump, half the country is going to be watching him. He's going to make his fortune. He's going to make his pile. But he's told the other half of the country that they don't belong. And this is the terrible thing that the press has done. The press has basically said to half the country, the half they never meet, the half they don't like, the half they disrespect, the half they don't even know. They don't know. They don't know you. They haven't seen you. They never talked to you. They never sat down with you. They don't know what your life is like. They really don't. That you are being told that you don't exist and you don't have the right to have an opinion. Your opinion is bad. You know, if you want to know why Donald Trump, an outlier, Donald Trump got elected, you know, I used to tell people who hated Trump, I would say for 60 years, people are told they stink. Their country stinks. Their religion stinks. Their lifestyle stinks. Their opinions stink. And now Donald Trump finally had the temerity, the courage to stand up and say, oh, yeah, you know, eat this. And basically people went, yeah, that's how I feel. You know, that's exactly how I feel. That's what the media has done to us. The media has torn us apart. And it is all that. It is all that. Because when we talk to one another so often, so many times, 70% of us agree on 70% of the issue. When we actually are face to face, we're actually listening to what the other one says. Most of us love this country. Most of us want good for this country. And we can disagree and still love one another. And we're going to have to learn to do that, the media notwithstanding.